thanks everyone, and thanks for giving me your time and to talk about the Book of Esther. It's a wonderful story. I think it's a favourite with many of us. But at the same time, it's a book that's come under a lot of criticism by the sceptics. And there's a lot to do with the timing and how we fit, who is Ahasuerus, and how we fit everyone in. So the objective of this class is going to be to try and give you some answers on to these questions. So tonight we're going to deal with the historical background to the Book of Esther. And then on next week, we'll get into, originally I was planning to make the authenticity a separate class, but rather than doing that, we'll do a little bit here and there. I'll weave it in because I think it could be just a bit too dry if we just focus on that. So in the second class, we'll ask the obvious question. What about the name of God in the Book of Esther? And so we'll do that, and then we'll go on to talk about Esther chapter 1, the characters of Ahasuerus and Vashti, and how this is a parable of the kingdom. And in the third class, we'll deal with Esther chapter 2, again, focusing on the characters, the parable of the kingdom and the characters of Esther and Mordecai. And we'll deal with Haman and the lesson that the flesh must be put to death. So we're only going to get as far as Esther chapter 3 in this series, but perhaps on another occasion we could go further. Okay, it reminds us that God is in control. He's the main character, even when his name is not directly mentioned. Okay, the king's name is mentioned 190 times in the whole book, but the name of God is not mentioned at all. But nevertheless, the whole thing, he's the hidden instigator behind the scenes. He's really the power behind the throne. He's who rules, the God who rules in the kingdoms of men. And we'll talk about that more next week, the name of God in the Book of Esther. Now, we know Israel's disobedience resulted in God raising up the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem and taking the Jews away into captivity. And then 70 years later, Cyrus the Great invaded Babylon and the Medo-Persian Empire commenced. And then the Jews were allowed to return home to Jerusalem. Now, sadly, most refused. They'd become Persianized. You see, this is the problem. They'd become fully entrenched in the culture of the kingdom around them. And the Jews of Esther's day were the grandchildren of those who were exiled. And so why return to a broken city? Many of them would have said, hard life, nothing there, rubble, a lot of work, when we've got everything here. So I guess there's a big lesson in that from the outset for all of us, isn't there? That we risk in this age of materialism being very comfortable and not putting with the things that we have in this life and not putting the work of God first in our life. So we've always got to remember this. And this partially explains why the Book of Esther never mentions Jerusalem, the temple, the Abrahamic covenant, or the Passover, or Yahweh. And it also answers the story that although God was disappointed with all those Jews who remained in Babylon, okay, he hadn't forgotten them. He still worked with them. And he was going to test their faith through some very trying means. He didn't give up on them, even though they didn't return. So tonight we want to look at the historical background of the Book of Esther. And what we aim to see is that Esther and Mordecai, understanding this background of Esther and Mordecai, gives us the key to understanding the background to these rebuilders of Jerusalem and the walls, Zerubbabel, Ezra and Nehemiah, and the prophets who prophesied in the same time, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Okay, so understanding the background to the Book of Esther is the same as understanding the background to all of these characters, these rebuilders and these builders and these prophets. So, Brother Dan, now let's read the first three verses of Esther chapter 1, please.
Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, that in those days, when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him.
Thanks, Dan. Now, Ahasuerus is a formal title. It's like Pharaoh to the Egyptians or Caesar to the Romans. It's not the name of a specific king. It's like being called the king. So in Old Persian, it's believed to mean mighty man or mighty eye from Aha and Suerus. And so in the days of Ahasuerus, okay, that is Ahasuerus' reign, it's equivalent to say in the days of his king, well, the king who ruled, you know, from India to Ethiopia, I'm talking about this king we're talking about. And India to Ethiopia was 127 provinces, okay, a vast empire. And it expanded from Daniel chapter 6 when it was 120, when Darius set over the kingdom and 120 princes, which would be over the whole kingdom. Now here we are in Esther chapter 1, and it's 127 provinces. So this is a massive empire, okay? Here's the Persian Empire on the map. And you can see in modern, if we just overlay the modern lands over that, we've got all through Turkey, okay, the land of obviously Syria and Israel, through to Iraq, all the area of Iran and Afghanistan, and down to the Indus River here in Pakistan. So this whole area, okay, is the area that the 127 provinces, and I think this map doesn't show it, but it's also into Egypt as well, was Ahasuerus' kingdom. Now, Shushan is the area, okay, the capital city or where the royal throne was. And it's known today, it's the ancient site of Susa, known today as the modern Iranian town of Shush. Be quiet, sound like shush up, be quiet. But anyway, this is where it is. You can see it's located there, east of the... It's located east of the Tigris River. So here's the Tigris, here's the Euphrates, Babylon's here. So it's about 160 miles east of the Tigris River in this area here. And you can see this map points out the Medes and the Persians. So it gives you an idea of the background of, in comparison to Babylon, where the Medes and the Persians, what area they originated from. So all that's left today is three gigantic mounds, you know, occupying an area of about 1 kilometre square, known as the Apanda Mound, the Acropolis Mound, and the Ville Royal, the Royal Town Mound. And so we know that in this same place, in this great citadel of Susa, okay, not only was Esther there, but we know that Daniel was there in Daniel chapter 8, wasn't he? And also in Nehemiah, it was Nehemiah who was in Shushan the palace, in the same palace, in the same area, the same location. So the question is, well, were they at similar times or were they at totally different times, separated by 50 or 100 years? So this map has a typical timeline that displays the kings of the 10 kings of the Persian Empire that are mentioned in most history books. And you can see we start on the left from Nebuchadnezzar's first year in 606, which was the first year, it was Jehoiakim's third year, and that was the time Daniel and his three friends were taken. And it was the start of the 70-year captivity. Okay, then in Nebuchadnezzar's seventh year, 599, it was Jehoiachin's first year. 10,000 captives are taken, including Jehoiachin, Ezekiel, and Mordecai at this time as well. And then 585, Zedekiah was taken and the temple destroyed. So, and then we have the Babylonian Empire through this period, and Cyrus the Great comes along in 550 to 530, 539. The Medo-Persian Empire took over the Babylonian Empire. And so then we have the 10 kings. We have Cyrus the Great, followed by Cambyses, who reigned for a short period. Then we had his son. Then we had Darius, followed by Xerxes, Artaxerxes, and then finally five successive Persian kings, okay, over this final period here, before the commencement of the Greek Empire. Now, I will say tonight, I've got a lot of maps and diagrams, and I will be moving a little bit quick on them. Probably the best thing is just to grasp the whole picture of what I'm saying, and I'll send the presentation material through to you all separately. So the question is that in chapter 2, verse 16, we read that Esther was taken in unto King Ahasuerus in the house royal in the seventh year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, so he sat the royal crown upon her head and made her queen. So the question is, who is the king, okay, that loved Esther above all the women? Who is the Ahasuerus? In the seventh year of the reign of Darius, was it of the reign of Darius, or was it in the reign of Xerxes? And you will note that in most cases, but in a lot of cases, like the NIV translation, they just straight out translate, instead of saying Ahasuerus, they say Xerxes. Okay, Esther chapter 1, verse 1, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces. So they just attribute it to this Xerxes here. But we'll see that there's no actual justification for that, and we've got to look a bit closer as to who is the correct king, whether it's Darius or Xerxes. All right, let's have a look at Mordecai. Our first step to working out, okay, who is the Ahasuerus of Esther, let's have a look at Mordecai's background and read Esther chapter 2, verses 5 to 7. Please, Brother Dan.
Now in Shushan, the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter.
Okay, thanks. So this gives us the family tree of Mordecai. Okay, he was, as it says, he was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, okay, and the son of Kish. And I put Gera in there as well. Okay, so the reason is because what's happening here is this is the time of the captivity from Jair on, but it seems that from Kish and Shimei, this is the time of David. So you will note, for example, in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verses 1 to 2, it speaks about Saul being the son of Kish. Okay, when it speaks about the background of Saul. And also in 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 5, when there came out a man to curse him without occasion, when Shimei cursed David, okay, he was of the family of the house of Saul. He was the son of Gera, the son of Kish. So it looks like in Mordecai's background, they're pointing out the emphasis here in this passage that he is of the line of Benjamin, that he's of the family of Saul. Okay, so I think this is appropriate, and the record's doing this for a specific reason, and that being that Mordecai, a Benjamite, ends Yahweh's war against Amalek. Okay, and we're going to see that about Haman, the Agagite. Okay, so this was a work that was actually entrusted to Saul, a Benjamite, but he failed. We all know he failed to carry this out. Now, there is a question on this in verse 6. Who was carried away from Jerusalem into captivity? If you read verse 5 and then you flow to verse 6, who is the subject? Who was carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity?
Yes. As a certain Jew named Mordecai.
Okay, that's right. So I think that's the natural reading. It's the natural reading to read it as Mordecai. Okay. Now there's another explanation that it could be Kish. Kish, who was carried away from Jerusalem. I'll give you that scenario in a minute. But I think the most natural reading is that this subject of verse 6 is speaking about Mordecai. And if we compare then, okay, assuming that Mordecai is the subject of Esther chapter 2, verse 6, that he was carried away from Jerusalem, then we can make a table here and compare two candidates for who is the Ahasuerus of Esther. Is it Darius, Hystaspes, or is it Xerxes? Okay, Darius came first, Xerxes was after. Well, we know that Mordecai was taken captivity in Nebuchadnezzar's seventh year, Jeconiah's captivity. So that's 599. And let's just assume that Mordecai was only 1 year old. He was a baby when that happened. Okay, he might have been older, but let's just, for the sake of this illustration, assume that he's just 1 year old. Then from that point, we've got 63 additional years of captivity, and the Jews return under Ezra first. So that would make Mordecai 64 at that point. Now, the beginning of Ahasuerus's reign, if it's Darius Hystaspes, it's 522, and that would make Mordecai 78. But now we run into trouble. If it's Xerxes, he's a lot later, well, that would make Mordecai 114. And so we follow that through. The seventh year of Ahasuerus' reign, Esther becomes queen. In the 12th year, Mordecai becomes prime minister. Well, if it's Darius in that year, Darius Hystaspes, when Mordecai becomes prime minister, he's 90 years old. If it's Xerxes, he's quite old, 126. So the simple point here is that Xerxes, based on the age of Mordecai, is highly unlikely. It's more likely, more reasonable to assume that Darius Hystaspes, okay, is the Ahasuerus of Esther. Now, the other possibility is to assume, rather than being Mordecai, it's Kish. Kish is Mordecai's grandfather. Okay, so instead of being way back in the time of David Kish, the father of Saul, it's another Kish who just happens to be Mordecai's great-grandfather, and the family line works through that. Now, if we do that, I won't bore you with the details here, but if we assume here that, well, if we assume that Mordecai was born, okay, that Kish is his grandfather, he's taken captivity in the seventh year, and follow it through when Shimei's born, makes some assumptions 5 years later, Jer's born 25, his son, and then his son, okay, Mordecai is born 25 years later, well, then we get to Xerxes of Ahasuerus, it becomes more reasonable. Then maybe this is a possibility. So simply, mate, the view that says Xerxes is the Ahasuerus typically interpret who was taken away into captivity as Kish and not Mordecai. That's I'm just giving you full disclosure about how they argue that Xerxes is the Ahasuerus, and this is one of the main points for this view. So it has some merit, but I think it's more a natural reading. The way the text reads, it's a more natural to understand the subject as Mordecai, and hence Mordecai would be too old if Xerxes is Ahasuerus. But we've got more evidence, so let's move on to that. Now, one thing is that if we look at the history of Darius, okay, the first year of Darius, Daniel's 70-week prophecy was given, Daniel chapter 9, verse 1. So here's Daniel in the first week of Darius. And then the second year of Darius, Haggai and Zechariah commenced prophesying. Over the second to the sixth year of Darius, the temple was built and finished. Now, the next event concerning Israel is in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. And it says in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, Ezra returned to Israel with the second group. And in the 20th year of Artaxerxes is the decree to build, Nehemiah leaves Persia to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. So the point I'm making here, and of course at that point the 70-week prophecy commenced, from the time of the rebuilding of the walls. Now, the problem, okay, is that Esther's position as queen, okay, if there's no influence on Jerusalem under both kings, okay, if God raised her up to be the queen, you would think there would be some influence in directing things in favor for the captives and the rebuilding of the wall. But if it's all happening in the area of Artaxerxes, as is mentioned in the book of Ezra, then Esther's role is somewhat mute. And likewise, in the first, the second, and the second, and the sixth year of Darius, Esther became the queen in the seventh year. So it seems that if we read the text as it is, it seems that, well, Well, what influence? We can ask the question, what influence did Esther have? Well, we've actually got to take a closer look at what Ezra and Nehemiah tell us about the Persian kings. So at this time, so in Ezra chapter 1, there was the proclamation of Cyrus to allow the Jews to return and rebuild the temple. And in Ezra chapter 2, approximately 50,000 exiles returned. Not everyone, only 50,000, as we said at the point. Most decided to stay in Babylon, in Persia. And then in Ezra chapter 3, the work commenced on rebuilding the altar and the temple. So that brings us to Ezra chapter 4. So could you read these verses on the screen? Now, please, Brother Dan.
Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the days of Artaxerxes, wrote Bishlam, Mithredath, Tabeel, and the rest of their companions unto Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the writing of the letter was written in the Syrian tongue and interpreted in the Syrian tongue. Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia.
Okay, thanks. So what's happening here? It's talking about opposition, okay? Opposition to the work of rebuilding, okay? And it's occurring, right? All the days of Cyrus, you see that in verse 5? All the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, until Darius, king of Persia, okay? So then in verse 6, we have in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, in the days of Artaxerxes, other people. And then in verse 24, the end of the chapter, then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So we've got to think about that. How do we explain Ahasuerus, if that is Xerxes and Artaxerxes? Okay, so the opposition to the work of the rebuilding occurred all the days of Cyrus, okay, until Darius, okay, they're all opposed to rebuilding. That's when the opposition happened, and it ceased during the reign of Darius here. So if the question is, how do we explain Ahasuerus, who's, if he's Xerxes, and Artaxerxes, if he's later on, what's the point of mentioning them here if it ceased in the second year of Darius? Why even mention these kings if they are Xerxes and Artaxerxes, as per the normal understanding? Well, there are other understandings of these as well. Every understanding is not normal. There's different interpretations, and you've got to try and fit things together. But according to 2 Fawcett's Bible Dictionary and the International Standard Bible Dictionary, they explain it as follows. So the Ahasuerus is Cambyses. Now, remember, as we said, Ahasuerus is just a title as a king. So Ahasuerus, Cambyses too, was Cyrus's son who reigned, okay, after him. And then before Darius, there was an imposter who briefly reigned and tried to take over the kingdom before Darius was successful for a few months. His name was Smerdis. And we'll see that Artaxerxes is a title as well, not a specific name. So this is how we explain what's going on here. Okay, between Cyrus and Darius, when the work finished, okay, when the work ceased here, we have two kings between them, Cambyses and Smerdis. And so that's why verses 6 and 7 mentioned in the reign of Ahasuerus, the king, Cambyses, and in verse 7, the days of Artaxerxes, which is Smerdis. Okay, so that's how we can explain that rationally. And then we read in Ezra chapter 6 and verses 14 to 15. Now, the subject here in Ezra chapter 6 is the rebuilding, okay, of the temple walls. It's rebuilding of the temple, sorry, not the walls of Jerusalem. Just remember that. Dan, could you read verse 14 and 15 here?
And the elders of the Jews builded it, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, and they builded and finished it, according to the commandment of the God of Israel, and according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And this house was finished in the third day of the month Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king.
Okay, thanks. So they built it and finished it. In other words, the temple, right? According to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes. And then it says in verse 15, the house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which is in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. Now, how do we work that out? If it was finished, okay, in the reign of Darius, why is it even mentioning Artaxerxes, who's the king after Xerxes? What's going on here? So it can't be the same Artaxerxes, okay, who stopped the building in chapter 4, verse 7. And it can't be Artaxerxes afterwards, because then his decree would be well after the temple rebuilding has finished. So rather, he gave the decree to rebuild, repair the walls of Jerusalem to Nehemiah. Is this this fellow Artaxerxes over here? That would make sense. So something's wrong here. Now, the solution is in the Hebrew. And sorry, before I say that, in verse 15, it clearly mentions, doesn't it, that the temple was finished. So there's no need for Artaxerxes here to make any decree regarding the house of the temple. But the possible solution has to do with the Hebrew. When it says here, according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, the possible solution is that the Hebrew and or wa can mean and, but, now, then, even, right, depending on the context. That's how it can be translated. Hence, this part of Ezra would be, Ezra 6 verse 14, this section here would read, even under the commandment of Cyrus and Darius, even, or who is? Artaxerxes, king of Persia. According to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius, even, or who is Artaxerxes. Okay? So that's what we're saying. Now, this is consistent with how Darius officially wrote about himself. Okay? So what I've done here, again, according to the commandment of Cyrus, Darius, even Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The name Artaxerxes is not a personal name, like Ahasuerus. It's a title name, like Pharaoh and Caesar. It's the Greek form of the Persian Artakashasta. Arta means great, Kashasta means king, and that's where we get the word Shah. It's an ancestral form of today's word Shah. That's where we get it from. So it's a title, okay? It means a great king, putting it together. And in today's language, we might call these men empress. And also, Artaxerxes, calling them 1, 2, 3, is actually an anachronism. Okay, that's a big word, but basically means it doesn't fit the time for that era. It's like saying the Apostle Paul traveled round Asia on a jumbo jet. It doesn't fit the time. You can't. So calling it Artaxerxes 1 is not how the Persian rulers referred to themselves like that. It's just that for whatever reason, today's historians have decided to do that. So both Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes are titles, not actual names. So it means a great king. So according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius, even the great king of Persia. So that makes sense. Now that's consistent with what Darius wrote himself on the behested inscription, okay, which is a monumental inscription engraved in rock that's of great historic significance. It's located in Iran and depicts Darius the Great, a king who started life as the son of an officer in Cyrus's army. He had humble backgrounds. And it's carved around 500 BC, and the inscription records Darius quelling several rebellions throughout the Persian Empire, the resulting from the death of Cyrus the Great and then his son Cambyses II, and the opposition he had from the impostor who reigned for a few months before Darius ascended on the throne. Now, these inscriptions include three versions of the same text, written in three different cuneiform script language, Old Persian, Elamite, and Babylonia. So this behested inscription is what the Rosetta Stone is to Egyptian hieroglyphics, right? So the Rosetta Stone enabled it, all the archaeologists to work out what the Egyptian inscriptions mean. It's the same with this inscription. This document enabled the decoding, okay, of all these wedge-shaped marks that you can see of the original Persian script, and it was found on multiple thousands of tablets and inscriptions. So it enabled them to translate based on the three known languages, Old Persian, Elamite, and Babylonian. So it reads, the first part reads, I am Darius, the great king, king of kings, the king of Persia, the king of countries, the son of Hystaspes, the grandson of Artemis, the Achaemenid. Now, so the great king is the same as Artaxerxes. Right? That's exactly what it means. And the King of Kings, well, that's what Ezra chapter 7, verse 12 says. Even Artaxerxes, the King of Kings. Just spelling it out, the great king, King of Kings. And that's exactly what we read historically on this beheaded inscription. Now, there's more evidence on this in the Apocrypha. Okay, now, the apocryphal books are not inspired, but nevertheless, they're an interesting historical reference point. So, there's actually two Apocrypha books for Esther. One is the Rest of Esther, and the other is the Book of Esdras. Okay, so in the Rest of Esther, first of all, in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the second year of the reign of Artaxerxes, the great, in the first day of the month, he sent Mardukes, the son of Jairus, son of Semuel, the son of Kisai, the tribe of Benjamin, had a dream. Okay, now that's parallel with what we see in Esther chapter 2 about Mordecai, the son of Jer, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Just for your information, I think the apocryphal books were written about 200 years after Esther was written. Okay, they're not part of the inspired script, but nevertheless, they do show how the Jews, who were a lot closer back then to what we are today, understood who these characters were. Now, in chapter 2 of the Rest of Esther, this apocryphal book, Mordecai took his rest in the court with Gabatha and Thara, the two eunuchs of the kings and keepers of the palace, who were about to lay hands upon Artaxerxes the king. So this incident of Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, okay, Bigthan and Tirsa. So it's the same incident. In Esther, the book of Esther, it's referring to the king Ahasuerus. In the Apocrypha, they're clearly identifying it as Artaxerxes. Okay, and then there's one more example in Esther chapter 1, with the Rest of Esther and Esther's, the second apocryphal book. So 3 verse 1, the great king Artaxerxes writes these things. In 3 verse 1, in the book of Esdras, the second apocryphal book. Now when Darius, they're calling him Darius, reigned, he made a great feast unto all his subjects, okay, that are under him from India and to Ethiopia, 127 provinces. So talking about the same, you know, the same king who made a feast to the 127 provinces. Esther chapter 1, it's the same, Ahasuerus. Okay, 127 provinces. So in the Rest of Esther's Apocrypha, it's Artaxerxes. In Esdras, it's Darius. In Esther, it's Ahasuerus. It's all the same king, just different names, different titles. All right, so the first year of his reign, it was this Darius, Artaxerxes, the king of kings. The first year of his reign, we had 120 provinces in Daniel chapter 6. By the time of the third year of his reign, there was 127 provinces. That's a providence misspelling there, sorry about that. And then, so he conquered all of the revolted provinces of the Persian Empire, as per the Behestin inscription, and now he reigned from India to Ethiopia. And so by the time the temple in Jerusalem was completed in the sixth year, he's recognized not just the king of Persia in Ezra chapter 6, verse 14, nor the king of Assyria, which is named in Ezra chapter 6, verse 22, but now as Artaxerxes, okay, the great king, the king of kings, Ezra chapter 7, verse 12. So I think we're seeing sufficient evidence to prove that the book of Esther is written in the time of Darius, okay, that Mordecai and Esther belong to the time of Darius. In Ezra chapter 6 and verse 14 to 15, as we just read before, The house was finished in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. Then if we look at Ezra chapter 7, the next chapter, it says, now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, Ezra the son of Sarai, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah, this Ezra went up from Babylon and he came to Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king. So if we take the traditional view, okay, that it's Artaxerxes 1, well, then we've got a 58-year gap between when the house was finished, okay, and then Ezra decides, oh, the house of God is finished, okay? And remember, this is Ezra who had prepared his heart to seek the Lord, to seek Yahweh, to do it, and to teach in Israel his statutes and judgments. Does it make more sense that when Ezra knew that the temple of God was finished, that immediately he would go in the next year, a few months later, that he would go to Jerusalem? Or would he wait 58 years? And so I think it makes more sense that it's only a few months, that Artaxerxes here, in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king, in the sixth year, and the next year, and he came to Jerusalem, Ezra, came to Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, the same king, Darius. Now, let's have a look at Ezra's family tree. Now, I won't get Dan to read this because it's a long list of names, and I'm simply going to illustrate it via these pictures to illustrate that Ezra comes from a line of high priests all the way back to Aaron. So he's Ezra, the son of Sarai, and it goes all the way back to Aaron. Now, in the middle of these names, there's a six-generation gap, okay, until you go back, as I said, all the way to Aaron. So Ezra, okay, was of the family of the priests. He's the son of Seraiah. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 6 and verse 14 to 15, we read that Azariah, here he is, Azariah begat Seraiah, who begat Jehozadak. Okay, so Jehozadak was the priest that went into captivity. Okay, so they're brothers. That's the point. Jehozadak was the last high priest who went into captivity. Ezra and Jehozadak are brothers. And therefore, once again, it's proving that Ezra was born before the captivity. And so, and then I will get Dan to read these verses from 2 Kings chapter 25 about Ezra's father, Sarai, being killed in at the time by Nebuchadnezzar in BC 580.
And in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which is the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem. And he burnt the house of the Lord, and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, and every great man's house burnt he with fire. And the captain of the guard took Seraiah, the chief priest, and Zephaniah, the second priest, and the three keepers of the door. And Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, took these and brought them to the king of Babylon, to Riblah. And the king of Babylon smote them and slew them at Riblah in the land of Hamath. So Judah was carried away out of their land.
Okay, so we can see that the captain of guard took Sarai, who was Ezra's father, okay, and the king of Babylon smote them, killed them. So Ezra's father died in B.C. 580. So that's an important time marker, a stamp, to establish a few things. So if the destruction of Jerusalem and when Sarai, Ezra's father, is killed, okay, it was in Nebuchadnezzar's 19th year, 580, let's assume that Ezra's age, at minimum, he was just a little baby, only 1 year old. Then you have the beginning of Darius's reign in 522, he's 59. Okay, the temple rebuilt in the sixth year of Darius, well, he's 64. Well, if Artaxerxes of Ezra, that's mentioned in Ezra chapter 7, 6 and 7, is in fact Darius, the same Darius, so Ezra goes to Jerusalem the next year, the seventh year, as we just read, 516, so Ezra's now 65. Then Nehemiah goes to Jerusalem, it's the 20th year of Darius's reign in that time, okay, so about 13 years later, Ezra's 78. And then in 491, the walls are finished, Ezra reads the law, it's the 32nd year of Darius's reign, Ezra's age would be 90, okay, based on that. Okay, he could be older because we only assumed he's one one up here. Could be 100. But if it's Artaxerxes I, like on the traditional or the normal historical teaching, a few years later, well then, you know, we get to Ezra. I won't bore you with these details, but we get to Ezra being 147 when Ezra reads the law. So the point is, it's highly unlikely. It's much more likely, again, that the Artaxerxes of Ezra is, in fact, Darius Hystaspes. So putting this together, there's a lot of evidence. There's more evidence favoring Darius to be the king at the time of Esther. Herodotus, with the help of, who was quite contemporary with this period, by the way, with the help of six princes, possibly six of the seven mentioned in chapter 1, verse 14, he says that Darius seized power from the usurper, Gomarta, Smerdis, who reigned for a few months, and ascended the throne in 522 BC. And he was occupied during the first few years of his reign with subduing revolts in the provinces and reconquering the empire founded by Cyrus. So that's consistent with what we see in the Bible. It's consistent with what we saw before in the Behistun inscription. So Esther chapter 1, the seven princes of Persia and Media. So Herodotus thought it was Darius I who, on his arrival at Susa, founded the council of the seven princes of Persia. So Herodotus notes that. The wife of Darius, during the first year of his reign, Darius married Atossa, and she was previously the twice married daughter of Cyrus for political reasons, to consolidate his claim to the throne. Now, let me explain that a bit more. So actually what happened in history, okay, is that Cyrus's son, Cambyses, and his daughter got married, okay? Brother and sister were married, okay? And then when, okay, Cyrus's son died, okay, the usurper married her as well in an attempt to claim the throne. And then finally, when Darius ascended the throne, he married her as well. Okay, so it's quite incestuous relationships here, but this is the background. James Usher, in his Annals of the World, equates Atossa with Vashtar. And according to Herodotus, Atossa was not his most favored wife. Rather, his most favored wife was the virgin Artistone, the younger daughter of Cyrus. But Usher suggests that is not correct, that Artistone was in fact Esther, whose Jewish origin had to be concealed by the Persian chronicles. But it's interesting that Darius honoured Artistone by making a golden statue of her. And even though Atossa was the mother of Xerxes, she's rarely mentioned in the Persepolis fortification tablets. Okay, now this is the largest coherent body of material on the Persian administration available, covering 15 years down to 493 during the reign of Darius. And one thing I'm going to point out just a few minutes later is there's a lot of information, a lot of records during the reign of Cyrus and Darius about what happened in Persia. But after that, history's blank. Now, Artistone, okay, in the fortification tablets, Artistuna, is mentioned as an influential woman who owned great estates. And if that is Esther, that would make sense because we know in Esther chapter 8, verse 1, that King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen. Okay, so that would have been quite a lot of land, quite a lot of wealth. And so that would make sense to say, for the historians to say that Esther is an influential woman who owned a lot of estate. So this may indicate that Atossa had lost favor with Darius, as the book of Esther indicates concerning that Vashti. So remember before I said, well, if Esther is in the reign of Xerxes here, well, Jerusalem doesn't really benefit. But if she is, in fact, in the reign of Darius, then Jerusalem truly benefits. As we said before, the first year of Darius, Daniel was given the 70-week prophecy. The second year, Haggai and Zechariah commenced their prophecies. The second to the sixth year, the temple work commenced and was finished. And in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, the seventh year of Darius, Esther becomes queen, and Ezra returns to Israel with a second group. Can you see that point? In the same year that Esther became queen, the seventh year, then Ezra returned to Israel with a second group. And then the 20th year of Artaxerxes or Darius, the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, Nehemiah leaves. So, you know, we know the prayer of Nehemiah, how it was a very nervous petition for him to come before the king. He was worried and troubled, and the king knew that something was on his mind, and he prayed to God about it. And so he came in before the king, and actually I'm getting ahead of myself here, and I'll go to the next slide where I've got this point. But so in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 4 to 6, he prayed to the God of heaven, and I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in my sight, that thou wouldst send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchre, that I may build it. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I sent him a time. So I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, the Bible doesn't randomly just say things here. It's deliberately telling us that the queen was sitting by him, and it makes sense. It's so much more meaningful to understand that that queen sitting by the king was, in fact, Esther. And so this king then had a lot of influence, okay, on what then happened with the rebuilding of the walls in Jerusalem. So cumulative evidence suggests that Darius Hystaspes, what we've looked at tonight of Ezra chapter 6, verses 14 to 15, is the same king of Artaxerxes in Ezra chapter 7 and throughout Nehemiah. But one problem remains. Does anyone know what that is? It's always a problem in trying to reconcile these kings from a biblical point of view. For those who are still awake.
Is there a gap? A gap to when the Greeks took over? Is it?
That could be. But from a biblical point of view, okay, there's an important time stamp that we can date from the period of Christ backwards.
Oh, the 70 weeks prophecy.
Exactly. Yeah, the 70 week prophecy. Okay, now it goes to around AD 34. So, if we go back from AD 34, we come to this Artaxerxes, 457. So how do we resolve that? And that's still a problem. The rebuilding of the walls, the commandment, the decree to go forth and rebuild the walls, it doesn't seem to fit what I'm telling you. Well, I think there's some difficulties with secular dating. And it's important to know that time periods are often overstated due to a number of factors, and this is the same for the Egyptian pharaohs as well, how they date them. There's co-regencies between a father and son. You know, they reigned over Latin periods, but when they calculate the time, it's actually they add them up separately. The effect of coups, after which a new ruler, okay, may attempt to alter the records, and they exaggerate the length of their reigns. Then there's dynasty splitting as well into two or more families. Okay, and they're reigning simultaneously but over different areas, and that means they're adding them up twice. And rulers using more than one name, often up to five, for different purposes. So it's difficult to put the pieces together. And this was actually a big focus. I don't know if some of you have seen this, but the Patterns of Evidence documentary. It's a very good documentary that reconciles the departure of Israel out of Egypt and into the land of Canaan. And so most of the secular scholars today will argue that Israel should have left Egypt is around 1250 BC, based on Ramses II being the Pharaoh of Exodus. And so then to discredit the Bible account, they say that there's no evidence that Israel left Egypt on a large scale, no evidence for the economic devastation of Egypt that would have occurred if the 10 plagues had happened. No evidence that Israel entered into Canaan at that time. No evidence that the walls of Jericho fell at that time. And then Israel went in and destroyed and took out many cities of Canaan at this particular period of history. However, the evidence from the Bible indicates that the Exodus should have happened, okay, around the previous, you know, around 200 years before that, around 446 BC. So if you move the date of the Exodus 200 years earlier, then all the archaeological evidence will start making sense and agreeing with the Bible. So this this documentary goes into that, and I think it's well worth watching. But the late date of 1250 BC, 200 years later, is proposed by most scholars, holding good intentions, but because they're placing more reliance on their archaeological assumptions rather than the chronological information that's actually provided in the Bible. So that's the key. I think with history, and it's no different with the kings of Persia and this time, the Bible provides the best important timestamps as to how we should be dating things. Now, it's interesting about this list of 10 kings and how they all came about and the dates about it. The traditional dating for the Persian kings rests almost entirely on a certain Ptolemy, properly called Claudius Ptolemaeus. Now, Ptolemy's list of 10 kings gave rise to the traditional chronology over 205 years. Now, who's Ptolemy? When did he? He wrote this in the 2nd century AD. So he put this history together 600 years after the events he was recording. And he wasn't even a historian. And look at this. His chronology of Persia is derived in part from calculations by one Eratosthenes of Libya, who devised a calendar on the basis of astronomical figures of doubtful value and not on written records. And there's no contemporary annals for the times of Imperial Persia after Darius the Great. As I said before, there's a lot of information, a lot of records that they have now, and they're still going through them for the reigns of Cyrus and Darius. But after that, it's a blank. Persian tradition itself only gives a period of 52 years. And so the 205-year length, okay, devised 600 years later by Ptolemy, is contradicted by the national traditions of Persia, the national traditions of Jews, the testimony of Josephus, and the conflicting evidence of well-authenticated events. Okay, and this is all from Morrow, a person by the name of Morrow, The Wonders of Bible Chronology, he wrote in this book. So as I was saying before, the Bible itself has to be our base. It's the most reliable reference point to date history because there's so many assumptions, so many unknowns when the secularists try and come up with a timeline. And this is what one particular writer said, okay, a man by the name of F. Jones, in his Chronology of the Old Testament. He said, yet despite the fact that he, Ptolemy, is merely a late 2nd century compiler, writing nearly 100 years after Jesus Christ, he's our only authority. He's our only authority, for no other system bridges the gulf from 747 BC to AD 137. So it's full of problems. It's based on a lot of assumptions. But hey, we're just going to stick with it because that's what we've been doing and we've got no other person to go by. Well, actually, you should stick to the Bible. The Bible itself is the most reliable reference point to date history. So with this in mind, I think what's gone on here is that the Persian kings, the period has been overstated. There's an overstating of the reign of these kings according to the traditional secular dates for all of these kings. And if we were to move it back 50 years, then it'd all make sense. Okay, so if these kings, the reign that they reign for is 50 years, 50 years overstated, move it back, then it would make sense. We've seen the evidence from the Bible that the 70-week prophecy was clearly in the time of Darius. Okay, so what's wrong is not what the Bible says. What's wrong is how the secular historians, and in this case Ptolemy, have given such a large time span to the whole Persian Empire. So another way to do it, assume that this period here, okay, from the five successive Persian kings in this period is overstated by 50 years. Okay, if we do that, okay, we're reducing the period down to 158 years for the whole Persian kings, and we're moving everyone forward. like this, okay, by 50 years. And if this is the case, then it all makes sense. Now, it's not a, you might criticize it, but I think that's the way I have come up with to reconcile the differences here and making the Bible, okay, this is a fixed point. We know this is a fixed point according to the Bible, making the Bible my base point. So we just adjusted it 50 years. All right, so let's conclude tonight's class on the background. What we've seen is that based on the cumulative evidence of the Bible's own statements and chronologies, the ages of Mordecai and Ezra, Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes being titles, not names, historical artifacts, including the Behest and Inscription of Darius the Great, and additional confirmation from the historical apocryphal writings, it's sufficient to prove that Esther was in fact married to Darius Hystaspes. Darius Hystaspes of Ezra chapter 6 is the same king as Artaxerxes in 7 verse 1, and he's the same king as the Artaxerxes of Nehemiah. Okay, they're all together. And as we've just been saying now, the Bible is the only contemporary historical writing we can find on this period, and the only one that even purports to give definite and precise chronological information about these kings. So from the days of Ezra and Nehemiah to the birth of Christ, that period, confusion and uncertainty exists in the historical records as a consequence of the acceptance of this highly unreliable chronology of Ptolemy. So tonight we've looked at the background of the book of Esther. Now, next week, we're going to start by looking at, well, why doesn't Esther have the name of God? And can we find the name of God in the book of Esther? Because many critics say, oh, well, it's, you know, hasn't even got the name of the God, and it's made up. The book of Esther was actually made up 200, 300 years later. and it's not a real event. It's just really something to grandize the Jews themselves. And they criticize the Bible along these lines. So we'll have a look at that for the first 15 minutes or so. And then the rest of the class will focus on Esther chapter 1, the parable of the kingdom, the character of Ahasuerus and Vashti. And then we'll continue that theme of the parable of the kingdom by focusing on the characters of Esther and Mordecai in the third class. And finally, we're going to deal with Haman. And the big lesson that comes from considering Haman is that human nature, the flesh in all of us, we've got to put it to death. Thank you very much.